Are we live?
Yeah.
I guess we're live. This is the pleasure of live radio. You're listening to the Pacifica Network coverage of the Green Convention. It is here at the University of Houston. It was partly today and also yesterday. And we're going to be with you for the next 4 hours. If you're listening in the Central Time Zone, that would be from 1 p.m. to 5 p.m. East Coast, 2 to 6. And I'm sure you can do the math on all the other time zones. I know that all five Pacifica stations are tuned in, so welcome to you wherever you are across the country. And don't have a total number on the number of affiliates who are joining us, but hopefully it's substantial. The audio today is going to be maybe different from what you would expect from Pacifica, because we are in an open convention hall. There's ambient background noise, and we're expecting occasional, perhaps quite disruptive interruptions from the loudspeaker system that is piped into our room, even though we're not on the convention hall itself. So if you hear stuff in the background, please excuse us. I should mention that my name is Mark Babawi. I have a show on Pacifica's KPFT station in Houston. Sitting next to me is Ann Garrison, who does some news stuff for BAI, and is it KPFA as well, Ann? Is that right?
Yes, and I'm an embedded journalist because I am a registered Green here at the Green Party Convention.
So Ann is with us, and you know, there's going to be a lot of stuff happening a little bit by the seat of the pants today. I'll give you a brief rundown of what we are hoping is going to happen, and then if you listen for the whole 4 hours, you might hear something other than what we hope. So between now and about 1:40, these times that I'm mentioning are all local, so central time. Between now and about 1:40, we're going to be playing various clips of interviews of attendees, delegates, and even one of the keynote speakers potentially. And then at around 1:40, we're expecting to hear live audio from the convention floor of Yanni Indigo. She's one of the keynote speakers. She'll be followed by Dr. Cornel West. Those two speeches, we think, are going to wrap up at around 2:15. From about 2:15 to roughly 3:15, we're going to be with you for the hour. And during that time, we have several people who are either here or are going to be over the phone that we'll be interviewing and discussing a whole range of topics. I'll give you a preview of at least one of them, and that is the whole spoiler effect, whether or not the Greens and, I guess, to some extent, the Libertarians pulling votes away from the two main parties and what impact that might have on the general election. I know that's going to be one of the topics. There'll be others as well. We have several interviews already lined up, and that's going to be predominantly covering the 2:15 to 3:15 hour. If the timing goes the way it's supposed to, at 3:15, we'll be hearing the acceptance speech of the vice presidential nominee, presumptive at this stage because the roll call hasn't been done. But he is, we think, going to be Ajamu Baraka, who has actually been on the Monitor show that I've done a couple of times. He's an interesting speaker and has a long commitment to many social justice issues. So I think that's going to be a pretty interesting speech, although I suspect it's going to be brief. One of the sort of recurring themes here at this convention is that all of the speeches are quite brief. Most of this morning, starting at 9 a.m. local time in Houston, all the way up to the lunch break at noon, there were all sorts of candidates and delegates speaking on the convention floor, and they very strictly enforced, from what I saw, a five-minute rule. So no one, no matter who they were, was allowed to speak for really any longer than that. So with that said, the vice presidential nomination acceptance speech is supposed to be 15 minutes from 3:15 to 3:30. And then the presidential nominee's acceptance speech, which again, we presume is going to be Jill Stein. It's, I guess, so we're waiting on the formality of the delegate counts and the roll call of states, which would be about 2:15 local time. So that's all coming up. It's going to be a pretty busy schedule. We invite you to stay with us and to experience the convention and to experience Pacifica's coverage of this convention in all of its live and slightly disjointed glory. Otis McClay is producing the show. We have some audio, Otis, which you can just wave at me and tell me that you're ready to punch it whenever you want. I want to give you a brief preview of an interview that I did yesterday with Yanni Indigo. She's going to be one of the keynote speakers here at about 1:40 p.m., we think. And I spoke with her about a number of issues, and I think we might play that soon, Otis, right, if you've got that fairly lined up. She may be familiar to you as being what they call a surrogate for the Bernie campaign. She was heavily featured in media. She was all over CNN. And she went kind of semi-viral with a confrontation, polite as it was, with a Hillary Clinton surrogate, and actually with the CNN host as well. And her response to both of them was effective enough that she became nationally known. And if you actually just search for her name online, the first hit that you get is that CNN interview. So if you don't know who she is, after you listen to this interview, which is about 17 minutes long, we may play the whole thing in one bit, but we might chop it. Just do a search and listen to who she is and how she's reacted. But you know, she was here at the convention yesterday, and I had a chance to sit down with her for about 20 minutes or so. And so we'll just jump straight into that. Go ahead, Otis. Joining us on the Pacifica Network coverage of the Green Convention is Yanni Indigo. I think you're known to most people as a supporter of Bernie Sanders, but I've been looking you up. You're also a musician, a singer, a human being, which is a nice thing to see. A mother, a daughter, a sister, and all of the rest of it. If you are known to the majority of the American public outside of your singing work as a supporter of Bernie Sanders, why are you at the Green Convention? What are you doing here?
Well, the reason that I support Bernie Sanders is because of where he stood on the things that matter to me, like wealth inequity, like the issues of mass incarceration, anti-war. So I'm much more moved and driven by the issues. My goal is just a beautiful world, the beautiful world that we really have every capability to build and create for all humanity and all living creatures and all plant life. And so I'm going to support any individuals who are driving things in that direction. So I supported Bernie's candidacy for that reason, and I support Jill's candidacy for the same reason. The other candidates that are in the field are not aligned with my principles, but Jill seems very aligned with my principles. And there are quite a number of ways in which she's even more aligned with my principles than even Bernie was. And so it's a very easy transition for me. I just want to continue the fight forward. And that's my life's mission, is to be a part of a world where everyone has food and a home, like those basic things that no animals really, unless they're in our cities that we've built, but like naturally no animal creatures are worrying about, like that we, no one should be worrying about that at all. And so I want to see that during my lifetime, a world of equity and equality and peace and abundance, or I should say, a world in which the abundance that is real and actual is actually converted into the lives of all of the people who exist in it. And so, the Green Party is an easy transition. I also don't really support the Democratic Party. And I like the fact that the Green Party is a small party that is ready and eager to become a party of the people, and that we would be able to work with the leadership of the Green Party to do whatever transformatively needs to happen and support their transformation into the party that the people need without having to start from scratch.
You're walking in an odd space that doesn't get discussed in the media a lot, and that is the difference that I think most people feel between what they would like to see and the so-called world of the possible, right? You have to be pragmatic. Bernie Sanders endorsed Hillary Clinton. From my perspective, against his better judgment, I think they have some pretty significant disagreements, but it seems like his priority now is to prevent a Trump presidency. And a lot of people are being very critical of Bernie Sanders supporters, either who are still supporters of his, saying, you know, Bernie or nothing. And they're not really addressing, for my money at least, they're not addressing the issues. They're focusing more on a prevention of a Trump candidacy or presidency, I should say, than what the differences between Bernie and Hillary actually were.
And I think that the bigger issue is that they're not focusing on the difference between their own principles and these candidates. The thing that people, I think, really need to be evolving to is looking at themselves and aligning themselves with whomever is in parallel with them, that is that is in harmony with them, regardless of where they're associated. So, for instance, I think most of us would have gotten behind Bernie if he had run Republican. And so we can imagine that, but we can't imagine stepping outside of the Republican and Democratic narrative. And so that holds people hostage to whatever the limitations are that those two parties create between the two of them. And those limitations are why we are still suffering from poverty. They're why we are still having people on the streets, living on the streets and having to beg in order to get food, why we don't have adequate education, why we are dealing with the threat of the climate emergency that we're in. Those two parties have been running our governments for centuries. So they're not working for us, but we're afraid to step outside of them because we keep buying into this idea that they keep perpetuating in order to keep us. And all we have to do is break free. It's kind of like money in our financial system. The only value that money has is that which we give it. If we all decided that we weren't dealing with money anymore, money would immediately lose all of its value. The Democratic Party, the Republican Party, the people who are leading those parties, they know that the only reason they have power is because we keep buying into the idea that they have that power. As soon as we let that idea go and we realize that we hold the power, then we can transform everything. We can change this world within a couple of years. We can eradicate poverty so quickly, but we have to actually decide that that's more important than all of these other, like, misnomer ideas that are being projected onto us. Trump is nothing. Trump is nothing. He's meaningless. He is not a reason to cast a vote, nor is Hillary Clinton a reason to cast a vote. The only reason to cast a vote is because of the principles that we have within our own hearts, and then to cast our vote based on those principles.
So the argument that is now presented by people who would take the time to listen to that sort of explanation, and there aren't too many of them, I don't think, in the media generally, but they would say, oh, great, so you're going to be FNADA 2.0. You know, by siphoning support away from the Democrats, you're going to allow the possibility of a Trump presidency. What do you say to that?
I think that is silly for a couple of reasons. One reason that is silly is because there's also a Libertarian Party candidate. So, and that party is the party that would be, if you're paying attention to this siphoning idea, siphoning from the Republican Party, so the two would end up canceling each other out. So that's number one. Additionally, though, the reality is that it only makes a difference if enough people decide they're going to do it. And if enough people decide they're going to do it, then that is actually a reflection of the Democratic Party in the first place. If the Democratic Party was actually being representative, if they were actually doing the, you know, moving forward with the will of the people, then there would be no threat of another party being able to cause them to lose their votes. And therefore, it's not the third party that's costing them, it's the Democratic Party that would be losing because of who they represent.
I have a lot of Democratic Party supporter friends and acquaintances and connections who are saying, well, look, you know, Hillary has adopted a lot of Bernie Sanders' positions. She now talks about improving healthcare provision. She talks about potential free state education at university level. And Bernie Sanders says this is the most progressive platform he's ever seen. But I've been around a little while, and I've seen other party platforms evaporate into nothing. They haven't delivered. If you look at the last DNC, a lot of the stuff that was in that platform was quite good, but it didn't get anywhere. How do you? What do you deal with? I'm sure people have come to you and asked you this question. Are you just utopian? Are you living in a dream? Let's deal with the reality. Are you not scared?
So when I'm talking to people, I'm just talking about the reality, the facts of like who these candidates are. I'm talking about like who is Jill Stein? What is it that she's saying? What is it that she's committing to? What is she driving towards? And what is it that Donald Trump, there's not really much to say about Donald Trump. Like he's just kind of like this caricature, right? So we all kind of know who he is you know, very easily. It's very superficial. But Hillary Clinton, there's so much under the surface. And if you look at the things that she's done, if you're going to vote for someone like that, like, you need to be questioning your own principles. If my assumption is that people don't know all of who she is. If they knew all of who she was, then they would not, they would no longer try to threaten anybody with Trump, because they realize that Trump is a speaker and she is a doer, and the things that she has done are really equivalent to the things that he has said. And so there's really no reason to vote for her, and especially because of him. They're like the same person, except that the fact that she's done these things actually makes her worse, in my opinion.
What, can you give me a couple of examples for people? You say people don't know what she's done. Just give me a highlight or two.
Okay, so like Haiti. Haiti is a great example. The Clinton Foundation, the Clintons received millions upon millions of dollars to go into Haiti after the earthquake and provide restorative services into the Haitian communities. What they did is they secured land for U.S. companies that was fertile firm land. So now you take generational wealth away from people and force them to work jobs. Those jobs, they're getting paid at that time 24 cents an hour, which was not a living wage in Haiti. I know there are different, you know, costs of livings and things mean different things in different places. It was not a living wage in Haiti. Then you have the State Department under her leadership, who negotiates the leadership of the Haiti to lower the increase to the minimum wage. They were going to increase the minimum wage to 61 cents an hour, and the State Department negotiated that they raise it only to 31 cents an hour. So again, you take the wealth of the people and an effort claiming that you're going to bring more opportunity. Those people don't get properly compensated for what they lose, and now they're enslaved to U.S. corporations who don't want to lose even like a small percentage of their profit, so that the people who are working there have the ability to take care of their most basic needs. That's one example of what. So, you know, I think a lot of people, they only look at things from a national perspective. And like, once you go to, you know, once you cross outside of the U.S. border, then it's like, well, what does that matter? You know, what are we paying attention to? I don't know if they're aware of the fact that they're looking at things in this way. But when you look at the Clintons' international policies, whether you look at Hillary Clinton in Haiti, when you look at, you know, her support of Zelaya's, you know, the coup in Honduras, if whether you look at, you know, the Clintons' response to what was happening during the Rwandan genocide and pulling the international community back from getting involved and preventing all of those murders and rapes and child soldiers, whether you look at, right, you look at Israel and which community they want to throw all their support behind in comparison to which community is actually experiencing the oppression. When you look at, you know, Syria, when you look at Libya, like, the, you know, like, there's there are certain very specific similarities in these communities. And the similarities are that they're black and brown communities and Muslim communities. You do not see these same approaches with other communities. So when you want to determine whether or not this is a racist individual, you look at what they've done, even more than you look at what they say. When you want to try to determine, like, do you know that Hillary is supporting the drafting of women, right? They want, she supports this idea of drafting women, and people.
But she's a feminist,
right? And some people might say, though, that's a feminist idea, like equality for every person. And on the surface, I can see that, right? But the reality, in addition, is why is that coming up right now? Why is the conversation about draft and women in a draft coming up at this moment, right before a Hillary Clinton presidency that has already indicated an intention to start war in Syria, start a war with Iran, start a war, you know, support warring efforts with Israel and Palestine? That's the reason why, because she wants to bring in more bodies for her wars. And if they need to be the bodies of my daughter and my nieces, then so be it. I'm sure Chelsea wouldn't get drafted, but my daughter's going to have to go to jail, and she doesn't want to fight a war, you know? So, and a war that none of us agree on and doesn't need to happen. So this is why I really stand so strongly against Hillary Clinton's presidency, and we'll fight it all the way through to November. You know, on the flip side, you know, people are talking about the need to start a new party. We need to get a new party. Here we have, you know, it's not an easy task to get a party and get it established and get it on the ballots, all of those things. Here we have a party. It's a small party, but it's been working. There have been people that have been doing this work for, you know, for decades. We can jump in here now and work with them to build that out. Take this energy, take this movement, and build this party out and help them to be what it is that they've been striving to be for so long. And, you know, and that which they would become would be what we need. So that just makes a lot more sense to me. And so I'm just going to continue to fight Hillary and at the same time build something that's for us.
Do you have a sense at all of how many Bernie supporters are now shifting away from the Democrats towards Greens and or Libertarians? And what do you say to those who are in that position of deciding or making that decision?
Well, I think that we don't have a good sense of that. And there are a lot of reporting that's coming and saying completely varied things. You know, it's kind of very similar to like how Hillary Clinton said that 95% of her emails were in the State Department, and the State Department said only 1% of her emails were in the State Department, were captured by the State Department. A very similar kind of thing is going on, where you have people that are saying very extremely different, you know, numbers. So one of the things that we are charged to do is to actually begin to help figure that out and to help people to identify themselves and identify with each other, find who else is in that space. So that's going to be one of the things that we're going to be strategizing towards, is helping to get those numbers and make them be actually accurate. I would say that we need to really be courageous and really look within our own hearts and make our decisions based on what it is that we want and desire rather than what we fear.
That was the voice of Yanni Indigo. She, I guess, I don't know if she still has the title, but she was a spokesperson for the Bernie or Bust movement, and she's giving one of the keynote speeches here at the Green Party convention at the University of Houston. You are listening to 4 hours of live coverage from the Pacifica Network live at the Green Party National Convention at the University of Houston. And as you might have heard in that interview, I think a recurring theme, not only around the Green Party, but also around the Libertarians, will be this idea of dilution of votes and whether people should be voting strategically or not. If you're in a swing state, what are you going to do? Are you going to vote your conscience? Are you going to vote to avoid the greater of the two evils by voting for the lesser? Strategery, as George Bush would say. I want to just share a few observations of what I've seen yesterday and today of the convention. And I guess one of the most useful ways of getting you to picture it would be as a way of, through contrast with the Democratic National Convention that I was at in 2012 with Pacifica, several other people. If you were there with me, welcome to you. I'm thinking particularly of Mitch Jezerich, who was there, and I wish he were here with us this time as well. So I guess if we put the two conventions side by side and look at the difference in scale, preparation, how sleekly produced they may or may not be, it probably wouldn't surprise you too much that the Democratic National Convention in 2012, I didn't go to this year's, was a very slick, multimedia, huge production. I think the number of journalists there probably outnumber the total number of attendees of the Green Party convention. I had a look at Fox News and CNN and other media outlets that were at the DNC, and each one of those people or companies brought huge teams of people in the 20s or 30s, some of them. Whereas the media at this convention, in part because of the narrative of the two-party state, which, as some people have said, Otis included and various others, it seems like a lot of people think that two parties is in the Constitution somewhere, and it isn't. It's not a constitutional issue. But somehow we have this two-party system. So here at the Green Convention, it's more definitely more relaxed. It's more low key. People are much more open and friendly, I think. And there's virtually no media of national significance other than Pacifica. There are a couple of local TV stations. I think Al Jazeera was here. Russia Today was here. But for the most part, it's small, independent freelancers, bloggers, photographers, people who are interested.
Real News Network.
The Real News Network is here, yes.
And TYT.
So yeah, I mean, there are some people here. The young Turks are here, and so there are some people who follow national politics closely, and it's not surprising that they would be here. But for the majority of Americans who consume a big chunk of their news from TV, you might not even really know this convention is happening. You might get a two-minute summary. I noticed that I think CBS, the local CBS affiliate, was here yesterday. They filmed very briefly. I see no sign of them here today. And so if you're the average American voter who gets the vast majority of his news or her news consumption through TV, you might not even know this convention is happening. You might not know what percentages there are. You might not know that this is actually historically high time in terms of people thinking about or already deciding to vote Green or Libertarian and not move towards the two main parties. So that's significant. And in part, I think it's very much related to the two candidates for the two main parties being the most disliked candidates, I think, in the history of presidential elections in America. Their disapproval ratings for both of them, that is Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump, are in the 60 to 70% range, which is historically high. And it is driving this potential growth between for both the Greens and the Libertarians. And this slightly uneasy friendship that I'm witnessing between Bernie supporters who have congregated here and people who have been involved with the Green Party for a substantial amount of time. So those observations, just how I've been feeling over the last 2 days being here, there are a few things that I find, perhaps a little bit ironic that could give you an indication of the difference between organizational levels and funding between national parties like the Democrats or the Republicans and the Greens. One example that sticks out in my mind is I thought it was a bit odd at the Green Party National Convention that the only food that I can buy right now is McDonald's. That tells you something. It's not in a massive arena like the two conventions that we saw last week and the week before that. But it's here, and it's happening, and people are getting involved. So those are my observations. Anne Garrison is sitting next to me, and I know, Anne, you have a bunch of other observations as well. You've been asking people questions about the platform and digging into the details a little bit. Tell us what you've seen.
I've attended a number of the workshops, but first I want to catch up on some news about the Green Party. Yesterday, a federal judge, threw out a lawsuit brought by Libertarian candidate Gary Johnson and Green Party candidate Jill Stein asking for inclusion in the presidential debates. Sort of astonishingly, this judge ruled that the Commission on Presidential Debates is a private entity, a private corporation, not a public forum, as the plaintiffs had argued.
Right.
And therefore, they have no right to claim spots in the debate.
That's not too surprising, I don't think.
No, it's not. And the rule that the Commission on Presidential Debates, which replaced the League of Women Voters after 1992 to keep any independent candidates off the ballot, is that a candidate has to be polling at 15% in three major nationally recognized polls to get into the debates. Now, the other news is about ballot access. I have a ballot access map in front of me right now.
Okay.
And there are 14 states where the Greens have not filed yet. In every other state, they've filed. In some states, they're already on the ballot. Or rather, this is Jill Stein. We're talking about the Jill Stein campaign. But if Jill gets on the ballot, then down-ticket candidates are on the ballot as well as Greens. So there are 14 states where they haven't filed yet. And most of the other 36 are states where she's already on. There are 7 where they've filed. No, it's eight states where they've filed and they're waiting for the response. In some of these states, really heroic efforts were made. In Pennsylvania, 5,000 signatures were required, and they filed 25,000.
And there are a couple of states, I'm looking kind of over your shoulder, there are a couple of states where people can write in.
Yes, there are three states. Well, there are three states where Jill will not be on the ballot, but there are two where she can be written in. They are North Carolina and Indiana. And that means that she'll be an official write-in candidate, probably like a lot of other people listening. I typically vote for my cat or my cousin for at least one office in every election, but neither my cat nor my cousin are counted, neither are yours, unless they're official candidates, unless they've officially registered to be write-in candidates. And Jill will be an official write-in candidate in North Carolina and Indiana.
So this brings up a few different points, and you're going to hear in the background now audio. I mentioned at the very beginning when we first came on that we're sitting in an overflow media room. Piped into this room is sound from the convention floor, so you will occasionally hear stuff in the back. You can hear some of it right now of people on stage bringing the convention back into order. And we don't have a lot of control over that sound, so we're working on it, as Otis says. And so you might occasionally hear some odd spikes of volume. You might hear people cheering. They're not cheering for any of us. They're cheering for what's going on the convention floor. But Anna, I wanted to go back a little bit to this presidential debate idea, because for me it confirms the almost enshrinement of the two-party system. If you are required to have 15% polling to be involved in the debates, and the organization running the debates is a private entity, for me, there are parallels with some arguments that I heard from various dissatisfied and disillusioned people during the primary season, where they said, you know, in the case of New York, for example, where whole districts had people removed from the voter rolls, or in some states where independents were allowed to vote in a Democratic and or Republican primary, and other states where they were not, the recurring argument seemed to be, well, these rule changes and all these, the way these parties are running, it's unconstitutional, it's illegal, it's, you know, it's wrong. Well, these are private organizations. The Democratic Party and the Republican Party are private organizations, and there are no national, federal, or even state laws that force them to run their parties in one way or another, as long as they don't, you know, violate the Constitution, for example. And there's nothing in the Constitution saying that the Republicans or the Democrats or the Greens or the Libertarians or anyone else have to hold their primaries in a particular fashion. And so when we have this situation of fairly disliked, to put it mildly, candidates for the two main parties, and people who are dissatisfied with either party or who are dissatisfied with the process generally, wanting to change things, they get very frustrated. And the things that you just mentioned now about the presidential debate really fit into that. How do you see this, or what do you think about the presidential debates and all the media coverage? And I'm asking you this to prompt you to say that Pacifica is a little bit different, because we don't cover this kind of stuff in the way that the corporate-owned press does.
Well, let me say, there's an article here today in Politico, which is not a radical publication, says, can the Green Party win with Jill not Hill? So Jill Stein and the Greens are being taken more seriously this year than any year I can remember, since 2000, when, yes, we had the N-word, Nader, which some of us are still proud of. I wanted to say about the ballot access issue that you were talking about.
And there's two different kinds of ballot access, right? So there's a ballot access during the primary season, which is one issue, and then there's ballot access when the actual presidential elections roll around, which is where we are now.
Yeah, and I did some reporting on ballot access and on things like open primaries, closed primaries. Every state does it differently. Sometimes counties do it differently.
Mm-hmm.
So to cover ballot access in the 50 states, you'd have to do 50 stories.
Right.
They all have these different rules.
Or 100, one for each party.
Yeah, yeah.
Two stories per state, one per party.
Yeah, and often different counties have different ways of voting and counting the vote.
And there was even, there were a couple of states that resolved a tie with a coin toss.
Oh, that was Iowa. Yeah. That was, yes, and somehow or other, Hillary won every single coin toss.
Right.
But Bruce Dixon and other people here, Richard Winger, who's the author of Ballot Access News, he's been following this for decades, advocate an amendment to the Constitution, which would be a Right to Vote Act, and this would do away with all these Byzantine local laws about voting and counting the vote.
Hmm. Well, I know that Bernie Sanders and some of his supporters have been pushing pretty hard about how the DNC as a private entity acted as the primaries were rolling around. And earlier this morning, here at the Green Party convention, there was a video feed in from the Ecuadorian embassy in the UK, and Julian Assange spoke briefly. And he was speaking with David Cobb, who's actually just walking by our table. I don't know if we'll be able to grab David for a quick soundbite or not. But WikiLeaks released, I think it was 30,000 emails from the DNC, which revealed something that many people who have been observing the primaries suspected was happening anyway, but now we have proof. And that is that the DNC was not acting in a completely detached way in the Democratic primaries. We can couple with that the story of the fundraising that the Hillary campaign was engaged in, which claimed during many of the primaries and a lot of the TV ads that the Hillary campaign ran to be raising funds for all Democrats, for down-ticket Democrats, as they said. And the evidence that we've seen points in other directions. It doesn't appear that that money is going to filter to down-ticket candidates, which contrasts with what the Bernie campaign was doing. Is that a fair assessment?
Yeah, I think so. And I wanted to say something else about the contrast between the two conventions, the environment, the amount of press, et cetera. Of course, this is a lot smaller. But I've been to workshops for several days on energy issues, on social organizing, on organizing frontline communities. And I was awed by the intellectual level and the political experience and engagement that people were bringing to these workshops.
Right. There's definitely a lot of energy. And a lot of the people who I've been seeing around who are delegates, who are longtime Green Party members, have clearly been doing this for a long time.
Yeah.
And again, the sound you hear in the background, which may be a little bit disruptive, is actually coming from the convention floor directly. And so we that's something we just have to try and deal with as things go by. What sort of topics were involved in these workshops? Can you remember a few of the ones that you saw?
Yeah, well, I've got several interviews with people who gave the workshops, and I think we're going to speak to David Cobb, who gave one on ending corporate personhood. Now, let's see. The one that was most important to me that I really came thinking about was the one given by Bruce Dixon and Howie Hawkins about how to reorganize the Green Party into a mass organization, a dues-paying mass organization. Now, I know everybody can gasp, oh, dues. Everybody wants money. One more person who wants money. Well, in Georgia, they're already planning to do this, and they're going to start with $15 a month. And Howie Hawkins, who was leading this workshop with Bruce Dixon, said, sorry, got a little distracted by the background noise, said, well, and if anybody really needs a waiver, we'll give them a waiver. No big deal. Trust that. But the Green Party is hobbled by not having any resources. And I can see why this is a problem, because I wrote a number of articles about the Green Party this year, about the ballot access issues and about what Bruce was saying about building the party into a mass party. And then people called me, or they wrote to me and said, why hasn't my local Green Party contacted me?
Why haven't they been in touch?
Yeah, this is really irresponsible of them not to be doing any outreach. Well, two of those calls...
Cost money, right, to do outreach.
Well, two of those calls were from Santa Cruz County and Mendocino County. So I looked at the websites, and I found that in both of those counties, they had a website, but nobody had done any work on the website for a number of years.
Mm.
And the only link for involvement linked to the state party. Now, Alameda County, San Francisco County, and Marin County all have green parties and county councils, and they could help. They could help people in Santa Cruz and Mendocino who who want to start green parties. And one thing that a party does for you is just explain the nuts and bolts of the political process. How do you become a party? How do you get on the ballot? What does a candidate have to do to run? But even the Alameda, San Francisco, and Marin Greens don't have a lot of staff to do that kind of outreach to Santa Cruz or Mendocino, or to respond if someone from those counties calls and says, how do I start a green party here?
Right. I hate to keep circling back to the same issue of funding, because I think it's so important. Where the money comes from and where the money goes is really one of the main answers to almost every question you can ask that's related to politics, in my opinion. And so when you get to why the Green Party is not bigger than it is, for me, it goes back to how the political process in this country functions and how much of it is tied into not only how the media works and what the media's connections might be, but also how political campaigns are funded and where the money comes from and what the laws are that regulate campaign finance. I mentioned in that interview with Yane the funding issue a little bit and the party platform issue, and that's something that we may come back to. I'm going to see if I can get some attention here from Otis for a second. Are we lining up David Cobb here in a minute?
Well, this,
because he's sitting there waiting, and some of these questions I think would be relevant for him. So David's going to come join us here. If you can throw on your headphones so you can hear yourself and us more clearly. There's a lot of kind of distracting background noise going on. For people who don't know who David Cobb is, you're actually a local, right? You're a Texan.
Well, I'm a Texan by birth. I live in Northern California now, but I will always be from Texas.
And I think we first came across each other back in 2004 when you were running on the Green Party ticket for president. We bumped into each other again yesterday, and we've sort of gotten real. Explain not only the current higher than usual interest in the Greens and the Libertarians, but what would it take for so-called third parties? And I don't like that term, but
let's call them alternative political parties,
or even just political parties.
How about that?
Because I was saying earlier that it's not in the Constitution that we're only supposed to have two. In theory, we can have as many as we want, and there are many countries that have many, many parties. Italy comes to mind, for example, but the United Kingdom and lots of other places. So how do the Greens deal with this issue of being squeezed out of media coverage, of being basically ignored by the media until they reach some sort of critical mass of, in the case of presidential debates, 15%? What do you do,
Mark,
about that?
I think that we need to really nail the context. The reality is that this system with the access to the ballot and the debates, the corporate-controlled media, the campaign financing, which have turned elections into auctions, where 158 countries literally are financing the major political parties, the racist nature of the criminal justice system and voter disenfranchisement. I could go down the list of the structural barriers. The United States of America is one of the least democratic countries when it comes to elections that exist on this planet. That's a shocking thing for most Americans. I doubt Pacifica listeners will be shocked by that, but I really do want to underscore just how profound that is. Mark, this is the reality. This system is not merely designed to prevent the Green Party or the Libertarian Party from succeeding. This system is literally designed to prevent the Green Party or the Libertarian Party from even existing. The fact that we exist at all is a minor miracle. The fact that we are electing more people to office, the fact that people are joining the Green Party by the hundreds of thousands, this is a testament to something very important, and that is this. We are in a historic moment. A series of crises, an ecological crisis, a political crisis, an economic crisis. These are systems crises. These crises aren't coming. They're here now, getting worse. And social movements are responding more acutely, more militantly, with more urgency than ever before. And let's just acknowledge Occupy Wall Street, mm-hmm. Black Lives Matter, Move to Amend, the climate justice movement, 15 Now, the call to end the prison industrial complex. The reality...
We're going to have to, sorry to interrupt you, David, we're going to have to cut in here because Yanni Indigo is speaking.
So yes.
We'll cut straight to her speech.
Mass incarceration we've been doing for generations. The idea of a
is what brought us mass incarceration. A political revolution has increased the number of people who have been deported from our country. A political revolution has caused the lives of millions of people across this globe in just within the last several years. We do not need a political revolution. What we need is an actual revolution. What we need to do, yeah, I was talking about this, you know, with various of my comrades, many of you I've talked to in this room. And the question comes up, how can you do that, right, when the systems in place are so powerful? And they are. And they've got all kinds of resources, including now drones that enable them to drop bombs on us like we're video game characters anytime they want to. They don't even have to feel the reality of what they're doing to people anymore, right? I mean, that's what we're dealing with right now. How do we do it? And my answer to that is we do it from inside of here. We do it amongst ourselves. So we have to start, and this goes back to a little bit about what we were talking about last Thursday. We got to go inside and understand what it is that we are holding on to and what it is that we are doing that is actually counter-revolutionary. So, for example, I would like all of the people in here, and I think that a good number of you will stand up, but I would like all of the people in here who are racist to stand up. Racist. Those people in here who are racist. All right, now all you people who are sitting down, you have work to do. Okay? You've got work to do. Because you can't be growing up in this system here and not be racist. It's not possible. It's not your fault. But you can't do anything to transform it if you can't even acknowledge it. I need you to say, hello, my name is, and I am a racist. I need you to say it. Thank you. That is the beginning of us being able to begin that transformational and revolutionary process. We have to be able to acknowledge that we've got so much crap inside of us that prevents us from being able to be the people we're striving to be all day long because we've been programmed by our media, we've been programmed by our magazines, by our movies, by the books we read, by the curriculum that we learn in our school. We have been programmed to be racist against each other and against ourselves. And if we don't deal with that programming, then we're going to be killing more people in more countries and in this country as the generations progress. So we have to acknowledge what's going on. That is where the revolution starts. So you got to understand what is not revolutionary when we're sitting here running around talking about being in a revolution. It is not revolutionary to have a president drop a microphone and then drop a bunch of bombs on a bunch of people across this earth. It's not revolutionary for us to not criticize a president simply because he's a black man and to hold on to him as somebody who's too important to criticize because he got swag, because he's walking around with a good-looking face and a smooth voice. It's not revolutionary for us to criticize the Secretary of State and act like that man is not her president. They act like that man is not her boss. That coup and horrendous that she supported, he supported that shit too. And I want you to understand that when you don't fight for the people of Honduras, then you are fighting against me. If you don't stand with the people of Rwanda, then you don't stand with me. You stand against me. Those are my brothers and sisters in Rwanda. Those are my brothers and sisters in Honduras. Those are my brothers and sisters in Haiti. Those are my brothers and sisters in Iraq. Those are my brothers and sisters in Libya. Those are my brothers and sisters in Syria. It don't matter that they're on the other side of the border. Buttons are nice. T-shirts with nice slogans are great. That's not revolutionary. Throwing on a T-shirt does not make you a revolutionary. You might be a revolutionary who throws on a T-shirt, but throwing on a T-shirt does not make you revolutionary, okay? We have been very much, I noticed a lot of Bernie supporters in here, right? Where are my Bernie supporters? I'm about to hurt y'all feelings again. I don't like to hurt your feelings, but I want you to know that I didn't come here to make y'all feel good. That's not what I came here to do today. I came here to push a little bit. I came here to challenge, because the reality is if we don't get this shit right, we're going to have the loss of our shores. We're going to have the loss of half our species, plant and animal species. We're going to have bombs exploding all over this country within the next year. We got to get this right. We got to understand what we're dealing with. We got to understand what we're up against, okay? Now, I want to read you just the first paragraph of an article that was written and published in Black Agenda Report, May of last year, by Brother Bruce Dixon, who I believe is here. All right. All right. The title of this article is Presidential Candidate Bernie Sanders Sheepdogging for Hillary and the Democrats in 2016. The sheepdog is a card the Democratic Party plays every presidential primary season when there's no White House Democrat running for re-election. Oh, I'm gonna stop jump the first paragraph. Vermont Senator and ostensible socialist Bernie Sanders is playing the sheepdog candidate for Hillary Clinton this year. Bernie's job is to warm up the crowd for Hillary, herding activists. Any activists up in here? Herding activist energies and the disaffected left back into the Democratic fold one more time. Bernie aims to tie up the activist energies and resources till the summer of 2016, when the only remaining choice will be the usual lesser of two evils. Anybody been hearing anybody talk about the lesser of two evils today? Anybody hear that talk over the summer of 2016? And I know the idea that Bernie would be working within this whole system while he's telling us that he's working against it is a hard idea. But this is the reality. It doesn't even matter.
Bernie tell you why still served that purpose as a beacon, and he pulled millions of unactivated people and got them involved in this system. He still caused millions of people to understand that we are living within a corrupt system. He caused us to find each other. Now we are prepared with the collectiveness to actually change this world. So if that was Bernie's intention, or if it was not Bernie's intention, it doesn't matter. What matters is that we let go of our hold to these personalities. You cannot be beholden to Barack Obama because he promised change and hope. You cannot be beholden to Hillary Clinton because she got hot sauce in her bag. And we cannot be beholden to Bernie Sanders either. We have to be beholden to the hundreds of thousands of children who don't have enough food to eat. We have to be beholden to the children who Hillary Clinton sent back to the country that she helped create all that upheaval in. Those children living in those dangerous conditions of Honduras that she created with her support, trying to escape that, and she wants to send them a message by sending them back. Those are the people who we have to be fighting for. We gotta acknowledge our privileges. We talk a lot about white privilege, and that's something that's a major conversation, it's an important conversation, because a lot of these stuff that we're talking about all fall under, as we discussed before, the umbrella of white supremacy. They all do. Animal justice issues, climate justice issues, social justice issues. They all fall under the umbrella of white supremacy. So white privilege is a significant and important thing that we need to be talking about, but we also have to acknowledge U.S. privilege. When we sit here and we want to talk about how the Clintons did some good things for the middle class here in the U.S., we ain't thinking about what they did to Rwanda. But does that not matter? They don't matter because they're on the other side of the earth. They matter to me. And if they don't matter to you, then that's something you need to be checking about. That's something you need to check about. We have to make sure that we identify our various privileges. And the U.S. privilege is a significant one because of the fact that the United States is the powerhouse of this entire world. We set the tone of what happens everywhere. If we don't do the right thing here, the world suffers. The entire world suffers. I don't want to see any more pictures of children with lips blown off. I don't want to watch any more videos of children crying because that building that was across the street, they watched it get blown up and their parents was inside of it. I don't want to see any more of that. I don't want to see any more of that. We got to make that shit stop.
Ooh, then that's something we have to do it. That's something
you
need to check.
It's our job right now to save this planet. It's our job right now to save humanity. And I don't want you guys to think that this is just some cute speech. I want you to understand that I mean this shit right here when I say that it is our job. We have to do it.
Everybody's
hearing
it. I'm not going to.
And I've been saying to my fans, I've been saying to my friends for a while that we have to make this happen, and we have to make it happen during my lifetime. I want to see it. But here's the thing, it don't take that long. If we get ourselves together and we become determined to make the first and most important thing the creation of an equitable world, then I believe that also my mother will see it. I believe my grandmother can see it. So my charge to you and my challenge to you is to get your boots on the ground, get your hands wet, make this world the world it was supposed to be. Do it right now. I want my grandmother to see the work that we have done. I want my grandmother to see that beautiful world that we have every ability to create. It can be done like that. We're going to have to do it. I want to hear you say we're going to do it. I want to hear you say you're going to do it. Thank you. Thank you. We're going to do it. It will be a revolution. Thank you.
We're going to go back to thank you.
We're back on? All right. You just heard there the voice of Yanni Indigo. This is live radio, and we don't have any way of controlling various words that are spoken. So at least my personal apologies to any of you who might have heard a couple of words escape there that shouldn't be on not only KPFT's airwaves and KPFA and WPFW and WBAI and all the Pacifica stations and all the affiliates that are tuned in. Hopefully there's someone in the production room there who has access to a button who might have saved you a couple of those words from going out on the air, but it's not in our control. Our apologies for that. I think the next speaker on the convention floor who's going to be introduced here in just a few minutes is Dr. Cornel West. We're going to go to that speech as soon as Cornel West is starting his speech. I'm going to hopefully get a wave in front of my face to let me know that that's happening. But we're going to come back to David Cobb here just for a couple of minutes. David, we interrupted you as you're making a very important point about ballot access and about how the corporate media in the U.S. and the presidential debates and all that are not only designed to prevent the Greens from flourishing or growing, but from even existing. And one of the points that Yana Indigo made in an interview that I did with her yesterday that we played earlier is that you as a U.S. Voter are essentially restricted to a paradigm that you can't really escape. You know, the point that keeps being, and I want to try and get this into a question so that it's not so open-ended. The point that a lot of people in the media, especially the Clinton supporters, are saying is a vote for Jill Stein is a vote for Trump.
So let's just take that head on, Mark. I mean, that's just ludicrous, right? I mean, a vote for Jill is a vote for Jill. A vote for Hillary is a vote for Hillary. A vote for Donald is a vote for Donald. I mean, that's just an assertion. The idea that any political party or candidate owns somebody's votes before it is cast is beyond ludicrous. It is reprehensible. It is disgusting. It is an insult to the very integrity of the idea that we have a functioning democratic republic. It is up to candidates to earn votes mm-hmm. by their policies, by their statements, by all of the various ways they do it. You know what? I want to take us back to 2000 when
the Nader campaign,
and remind people that polling data shows that about 250,000 registered Democrats voted for George Bush. So if you want to look for anybody to blame for George Bush, blame the Democratic Party for running a terrible campaign. Blame the Democratic Party for not being able to inspire their voters to vote for their candidate. Way more Democrats voted for George Bush than they did for Ralph Nader. So this whole notion of you have to cast your vote for one or the other.
All of you.
Is, I think, just absolutely ridiculous. Here's the other thing. In light of all the structural barriers that are before us, the Greens and the Libertarians are growing, getting larger, stronger, and better organized.
Despite all of that.
Despite all of that. And I'll tell you why. Because the acute crises that we're facing now, these systemic crises, there are militant social movements, Occupy Labor, Black Lives Matter, Move to Amend, the climate justice movement, 15 mm-hmm. Now. All of these movements are getting larger, stronger, better organizing,
right.
making better, more demands. I submit to you those constituencies and movements will either just utterly transform the existing Democratic Party, or they will destroy it, because those movements cannot be contained within the corporate-controlled imperialist party that the Democratic Party represents. They simply